I am a great believer in the ancient wisdom that older people have wisdom that younger people do not have. That's the wisdom that comes with longevity, because a brain that has seen bad things happen, and of course, bad things happen to all of us, and a brain that has known that you can get over that, and a brain that also knows humility, that knows that even if you're up there and you've achieved as much as you ever want to achieve, that sense of achievement is not going to last. So even if your abstract facilities decline, there is always that background wisdom. If you accept everything that's happening around you, if you accept the inevitable decline, I think that wisdom is worth an awful lot.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Places podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of people in medicine and science by focusing on people and their stories. I'm joined today by Veronica O'Keen, who's a professor of psychiatry and a consultant psychiatrist at Trinity College Dublin, with over 30 years of experience in the field. She has published numerous research papers, especially on mood disorders and on perinatal depression. She's the author of a book, A Sense of Self, Memory, the Brain and Who We Are, as well as The Rag and Bone Shop, How We Make Memories and Memories Make Us. She lives by the sea in North Dublin and is a passionate open sea swimmer. Welcome, Veronica. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Ethan, for having me on.
Well, let's start with your career journey. You've had a long and varied career. Can you talk us through this and going right back to where you grew up? And would you say it took any surprising turns?
I certainly knew what I wanted. And I decided at quite a young age that I wanted to be a scientist. And I also realized that the most interesting thing in the world for me then and for me now is the brain. And at that stage, psychology wasn't a hugely developed area. And psychiatry didn't have a lot of psychology, or didn't seem to have a lot of brain in it, actually. Strange and all as that may sound these days, you know, the era of neuroscience hadn't come yet. Anyway, I decided that I was more likely to learn about the brain if I did medicine, which I did, and I immediately went into doing psychiatry. So there was no dithering, and I was very clear-sighted about having my eye on the brain. And I guess neuroscience really only developed as a discipline during the 1990s, which was called the decade of the brain. And before that, the brain really, in terms of medicine, knowledge about the brain resided in the discipline of neurology. And I was very interested, and it's been really, I suppose, my life's work in a political sense, if you like, in an intellectual sense, is bringing the brain into psychiatry. And I really think that neuroscience comes to life when we're talking about the way we experience the world and the way we behave. So I've always been interested in, I guess, translational neuroscience and how that informs the human experience and the human condition. So I obviously followed an academic career because I was looking for explanations and illuminations. And that led me to various parts in the UK. I was in the Maudsley Hospital, which is the oldest hospital in Europe and has a very long tradition of excellence. And I learned lots of things there, genetics, neuroimaging, and I honed my own skills. I mean, the area that I honed in on then really was looking at how the body and the brain were connected, and the system I was most interested in was the hormone system, the endocrine system. So I would have been one of a small group of people in the 1990s who was interested in brain stress. Everybody's interested in it now. But when we began talking about cortisol in the brain, what is self-evident now and what is talked about on chat shows, we were groping our way through it back then. So then I progressed from that to, I went to Cambridge for a few years. And then my personal life in the form of two babies pulled me back to Dublin, and my desire to bring them up in Ireland, and a primitive desire, which I've often thought about in terms of my brain pathways, but it remains a mystery to me. And then hence on to the chair in Trinity and my research, neuroimaging and neuroendocrine research in mood disorders.
Fascinating. And as you said, you were ahead of your time in recognizing the link between some of these. I'd love to ask, because I've actually studied neuroscience myself, what new advances most excite you in terms of what we're finding out about? And where do you think the promise lies, maybe for unlocking some of the problems that we haven't been able to solve? I'm just thinking whether it relates to neurodegenerative conditions or maybe conditions like autism. Where do you see some of the excitement today?
One of the areas that I think is very exciting is also one of the areas that most irritates me. And that is the area of diagnosing or recognizing patterns of ways of being in the world. And autism, actually, now that you mention it, is a very interesting one, because we are all more or less socially intelligent. We are all more or less forthright, and we are all more or less aware of our own emotional states and emotional states of others. And of course, they're very highly correlated. But it's quite difficult being in clinical practice where children are being looked at in a very unbalanced and microscopic way and may not be living up to their parents' idea of what their child should be, the level they should be functioning at intellectually or socially. So disorders have become spectrumized. And I think we're less tolerant in a sense of our own ways of being in the world and our limitations. And there is, I think, a striving towards an idealized sort of way of being where you're on full cognitive drive all the time, you're emotionally aware, you're tuned into everything. So I think we're putting a lot of pressure on people. And I think a lot of that does come from discoveries in neuroscience, particularly, you know, as I said, in the developmental front. And the other disadvantage of that is that I think it's marginalized people who have psychiatric illnesses. So everybody is a mood disorder, everybody's anxious, everybody is on the spectrum, on one spectrum or another spectrum. But it's our patients who are really the most sick, who are very psychotic, or who are really bipolar. And we're not using bipolar as an adjective here. We're looking at a devastating disease that has ravaged a person's brain, their only brain. And if it's bad enough, it will eat away at your brain the same way that a bad metabolic disease will eat away at your liver or your pancreas and so on and so forth. So I think there's the pathologizing of normal behavior. And then there is also the marginalization of people who are very ill. And that's in the clinical neurosciences. In the neurosciences more generally, I think it's hugely positive. I just love people finding out about their brains. I love people making connections between the experiences they have and what might be happening in their brains. And I've seen it since I've written my book and spoke to my friends. Sometimes they, you know, we may be out together and they'd say, well, you know, I got that smell. That must be, you know, that nerve that goes to my nose. What do you call it, Veronica? I'd say, oh, the amygdala. Yes. And I love that. I love people having a sense of the vibrancy of their own brains and how exciting it is to think about the way your brain is functioning. And I think people are very excited about their brains. People are endlessly curious about themselves. So I'm in a very nice position of being able to supply information that everybody's very receptive towards. So I like that.
Well, I love that. I'm going to ask you later about holistic care of the brain, because if we're interested in it, curious about it, then a natural corollary from that is wanting to take care of it in a way. But first of all, I want to move to some of the topics of your books, because there's so much there that I think is fascinating. One of the things you've been quoted as saying is that the best way to understand normal experiences is through examination of the abnormal. Can you give us some examples of that and what you mean?
This was said by one of my all-time heroes, William James, who's the brother of Henry James, the famous novelist. And Henry James is very well known for being psychologically minded and for understanding stream of consciousness. But it's actually William James who coined that phrase, stream of consciousness, not his brother and not Freud. I'm not a huge fan of Freud, it has to be said, but William James was a very literary scientist. So his writings are beautiful. And I have them all. And I always go back to them in the spirit of going back to the person who is the originator of lots of ideas that have flown from that point. And he really is one of the originals. And I think this is true. I think the world probably experienced that following Oliver Sacks' books about neurology, which became hugely famous because he really showed the world that when bits of the brain were awry, that you would have particular and sometimes very peculiar neurological dysfunctions, like the man who mistook his wife for a hat, and, you know, people who cannot recognize facial features. And they're otherwise cognitively normal, sometimes sophisticated, but the facial recognition part of their brain is obliterated. And so people then began to think, oh, yeah, well, that's very highly developed. I recognize faces for 20 years. And they began thinking about their own brains. They begin to see how it feeds into emotional intelligence. They begin to understand new facets of the way they operate in the world and the way other people operate in the world. So he did that. And in a sense, I'm trying to do that in a way in psychiatry. So by saying to people that, for example, if somebody is very psychotic and they have a psychotic experience, that will be remembered by them as a true experience because it is a physiological process. And in the book, I use the example of a woman who had a postpartum psychosis. This is a psychosis that hits about 0.5% of women who give birth to live babies. And it just falls upon them suddenly. In one in two cases, 50% of cases, there's no precedent of any sort of mental ill health. And they go from being normal to being as psychotic as a human can be. And it's a psychiatric emergency if a woman becomes psychotic like this. Basically, what happens is she becomes incredibly confused, bewildered, doesn't recognize her baby, doesn't recognize her husband anymore. And it's hugely distressing for everybody involved. Anyway, what we do in cases like that is we bring them into hospital immediately and we give them antipsychotic medication. Everybody would be very glad to hear, if they don't know already, that it's a hugely effective treatment and that most women get better very quickly and they get reunited with their babies and they go on to live fully normal lives. So the outcome is excellent. The treatment is very effective, but it's a devastating blow for a woman and a family if she's lucky enough to have one. So this woman, Edith, whom I call Edith in the book, fell into a shocking postpartum psychosis after her baby was born and believed that her baby was the child of the devil. And she believed that the baby was a substitute in some way or other, and that her real baby had been taken away and killed. And so she knew that somebody around her had done it, so she couldn't talk to anyone, and she became more and more suspicious. She could smell rot from the baby, and she believed that rotting smell was because the baby wasn't a human baby. And so all these experiences, she was hearing voices telling her that the baby wasn't her true baby. In the way that you're hearing my voice now, she heard voices in external space. I think people often think the voices are in people's heads. In psychosis, they're out there in the vibrating in external air like any other voice does and hitting one's eardrum. So it's exactly the same experience if you're psychotic and hearing a voice. So Edith was being brought to the psychiatric hospital. The GP obviously saw what was going on and she was brought into us immediately. And on the way into the hospital, she passed a graveyard. And there was a gravestone in the graveyard that was very old and had presumably tilted because of its age. And it was a small headstone. And she immediately knew. There was no doubt in her mind that that was where her baby was buried. Her baby had been killed and had been buried there. Anyway, the story of her treatment is separate. It was very successful. Some weeks later, she was reunited with the baby. She went home and she came back to me for outpatient care. And on her first return appointment to me, she passed by the same graveyard and told me when we met that it was a terrible experience for her. And I said, well, you do understand, of course, that that's a false memory. That didn't actually really happen. And she looked at me and she said, it may never have happened, but the memory is real. So it just suddenly struck me, actually, if you're psychotic and you have a psychotic experience, you're going to lay it down physiologically in your nerve networks as an absolutely genuine, real experience. Of course, I knew this, but there was something about the way she said it to me that really made an impact on me. And I realized that in a way, when we're talking to people who've had psychotic experiences, or to anyone actually, but particularly in psychosis, that whatever way a person remembers something is laid down in the memory as a matter of memory, physiologically a matter, as connections between neurons. And if that is a memory, if that is laid down in your brain, that is the way your brain is going to filter further information. So when she passed by the graveyard on her way to the return appointment, that memory was reactivated. So for about less than a minute, she was back in that psychotic with the fear, the beliefs, and everything else. She was seeing it from a distance, but she was actually experiencing it because that memory, those neural connections had been reactivated. So memory is a very substantial thing. It exists in brain tissue. And I guess Edith taught me a lot, and patients have taught me a lot. So in a way, that's the Jamesian aphorism of, I have learned so much about normal brain from looking at abnormal brains.
Well, that's fascinating and a perfect segue into your latest book about memory. Love to know, besides being, I suppose, surprised at how memory can be laid down, even by experiences that didn't actually happen, did anything else surprise you about your research? How can we all maybe use some of what you learned in our daily lives towards our own better mental health, better well-being?
I think the thing about neuroscience, as I said already, is the awareness that it gives everybody. And I think in terms of understanding other people's way of being in the world, we all know it's important to understand people's development and their background. But the thing about memory is it lives on in the present. Memory exists only in consciousness. And we only have memories because we're consciousness. And in many ways, our consciousness is a composite of all the memories that we've laid down and the present world, what's happening to us. So we live and breathe in our memories. And that is the only tool that we have for predicting the future as well. So you may see it as a concretized way, but in a way, it's a very cognitively flexible model for understanding other people. And I suppose we're all involved in our own psychotherapy. We're all involved in our own mental health and the mental health of our loved ones. And awareness and increasing understanding, I think, is key. I'm not as keen on these, you know, the cognitive tests, the crosswords and the Sudokus. I think they're great, but that's exercising one aspect of your memory, a very mechanistic aspect of your memory. I think it's also very important to try and stimulate the emotional aspect of memory and become emotionally aware of things in your life that is shaping the way you perceive the world at the moment. And similarly for other people, I mean, that is all memory as well. And also memory, as we age, we have the huge advantage of the abstraction in our brain developing. So we're much more capable of thinking conceptually. And I think developing our conceptual understanding is just as important as doing the Sudokus and all the memory tricks that were given. Like, when you're my age, you never know where your keys are unless you put them in the same spot all the time. Or, you know, you have to have a place for everything. And that's fine. I've adapted to that. And I find, yes, there are handicaps, but it's not that difficult. I can do a Sudoku, I can do a crossword if I wanted to, but I don't. I actually want to get in deeper, and I want to go up higher. I want to exploit the good things that are happening in my brain and not just try to hang on to the bits that are fraying at the edges.
That's fascinating. So as we age, our ability to abstract thoughts improves. And then, of course, we know also as we age, certain other things start to decline, even as you mentioned, the short-term memory, perhaps, or where you put the keys. Does it peak at a certain point, or does the brain continuously improve in its ability to have abstract thoughts or to delineate between different thoughts?
Well, sadly, no. Sadly, there does come a point when we decline. But I am a great believer in the ancient wisdom that older people have a wisdom that younger people do not have. And I guess that's the wisdom that comes with longevity, that you can never make that artificial, because a brain that has seen bad things happen, and of course, bad things happen to all of us, and a brain that has known that you can get over that and you can get back to a point of being that might even be better than that. A brain that knows that, and a brain that also knows humility, that knows that even if you're up there and you've achieved as much as you ever want to achieve, that that sense of achievement is not going to last. So even if your abstract facilities decline, there is always that background wisdom, you know, if you accept everything that's happening around you, if you accept the inevitable decline. I think that wisdom is worth an awful lot. And I do think it is a social function as well, because it's the little ones, you know, what I call the little ones now, the little ones between 15 and 25, it's the little ones who kill themselves. It's an absolute tragedy. And I think that's because they don't have that wisdom. They don't have that longevity. So I do think that older people have a lot to contribute to society from that point of view that we're not really doing. We're very compartmentalized in terms of intergenerational mixing. So to answer your question, yes, the brain declines, but there is kind of a distilled wisdom that remains there. And that I think is a huge benefit to the individual and to society. Yeah, everything fails in the end, Ethan, doesn't it?
Well, it's fascinating because that's exactly, in a way, you've summed up so much of what I have learned through osmosis through doing this podcast, which is firstly that we have to understand where people come from. That's why I always ask the first question about your upbringing. Where were you raised? Did your family own a business? Did your family work in the world of, were they in the professional sphere? You know, how did you grow up? What was your experience like? Were there setbacks? I ask those questions just instinctively wanting to build a picture of the person. And then the end of the podcast is always back to reflections. And in fact, I found that important, particularly the people who are more senior in their careers, their reflections are extremely valuable because they've had this perspective. They've had this advice for their younger self. I want to amplify those reflections and pass them on, not only because it fills out the person, but it also is a way of kind of amplifying wisdom and passing it down, which is something we need to do. And finally, just recently, we've begun to talk more about ageism and how much older people are actually excluded from the workforce, not embraced, excluded. And one of our previous guests talked about it almost being one of the last acceptable forms of discrimination and how we hold older people to higher standards. We have biases that persist. So much you're saying is extremely relevant. I've come to it just through discovery, but it's wonderful to actually now be able to sum it up. And I think you've tied together beautifully two of the topics of your first two books. One of the one I'd like to ask you about as well is something you said about mental illness being the last major area of human medicine that needs to be enlightened by science. Obviously, neuroscience is helping with that enlightenment. How close are we to that enlightenment now?
Well, my colleagues would say in clinical medicine and also really in academic medicine that we're really, really far from knowing anything. I don't agree, but I also believe in the Enlightenment, and I do believe that we are evolving as a species. So I am absolutely in the optimistic camp about the human project. So I suppose it is no wonder I would take that line. I think, first of all, the demedicalization of, the expansion of neuroscience into everyday mental health is hugely helpful. I mean, that in itself is a revolution. When I was a child, I remember one of my parents said to me, they're both dead now, but I still feel I don't want to identify which one said this. You know, I was full of all sorts of wrong beliefs, and when I was 14 or 15, I was becoming an atheist. I was becoming a socialist. I was becoming socially unacceptable, actually. And my parents very much wanted me not to talk to any of their friends or in public or in school. And I had a discussion with them. And one of them said to me, "We're thinking very seriously about bringing you to a psychologist." And that was like the worst thing you could say to a child 50 years ago, was to go to a psychologist, because that meant that there was something wrong with you mentally. So I think we have come a huge way. And even just the idea of going to a psychologist now is seen as something really positive, which of course it is, of understanding yourself. All of these things, we were basically told not to respond to the world. You know, we were given a rigorous set of moral values. You operated within those moral values. Your beliefs lay within the boundaries of those moral values. And the emotional self, the intellectual self, was not allowed to develop. So I think we, because of neuroscience, because of the evolution of humanism, I think we've become more and more humane, more and more aware. So I think even in itself, outside of the clinical sciences, that has been an enormous development, and it's central to what I would see as one of the main goals of neuroscience, of clinical neuroscience, which is to give everybody better mental health, but treat sickness. So we come back to sickness. At least we know now the areas of the brain that are involved. We know, for example, it's the highly integrative areas of the brain that are involved. The neurologists have the surface of the brain. Things are relatively easy for the neurologists. It's sensory, it's motor, it's complicated motor stuff. The psychiatrists get the innards and the hubs and the integration centers where memory comes with emotion. Memory, emotion, and cognition get mixed up. And then you've got OCD, where the motor system comes in and is some way involved in over-inhibiting the cognitive system. So we're getting these very densely interconnected hubs. And as these become untangled, what used to happen historically is they would go over to neurology, because basically psychiatry was the science of the unknown. It was the unknown bits of the brain. It was what was called functional. So we had this functional. I asked for 20 years, I asked senior colleagues, "What do you mean by functional?" They said, "Well, functional brain disorders." I said, "Well, structure and function are the same. You take a neurotransmitter and you take a receptor. The receptor is a functional unit. It has a certain shape. It is built by proteins. It is a structure. It is a very small structure, but nonetheless a structure. And it also has a function. When the neurotransmitter comes into it, that's what lights up the nerve." So, you know, it has been demonstrated conceptually in science that structure and function are inseparable. You know, how can, as our wonderful poet W.B. Yeats says, how can you tell the dancer from the dance? So I guess that dualism, separating out structure from function, separating out matter from spirit, all of that really has bedeviled psychiatry. And I think the fact that we're coming, you know, being able to image the brain, being able to measure chemicals from the brain, has allowed us to at least point to areas of the brain. Actually, that's what's wrong. It's not the spirit. It's not function. You know, it's not function. It is organic. It is something, but it's so complex that we're only at the edges chipping away at understanding what it might be. And I have been very happy at the edges, because I think every small advance, it's a new advance, and it's hugely important. Even if people might think a dissertation on something very esoteric has no meaning, but these are the things that do have meaning ultimately. Nuclear power, for example, and the Hadron, what they're doing with the Hadron now, it might seem like an awful lot of money to invest in something. But of course, you know, I think ultimately we are going to have to go into the atom to get energy. So ultimately, impact, and we will slowly and modestly make inroads into understanding what is wrong in mental disorders. In depression, for example, we already know it's got something to do with memory and how memory is integrated with the front of the brain. And we wouldn't have known that 30 years ago. So everything, it's in evolution, but it has to be modest because we're dealing with massively complex systems.
Right, exactly. And that's a wonderful point. And I want to tie this back now to something we spoke about earlier, which is around nurturing. We're more aware of our brains now, but the importance of nurturing them. And I know you're a passionate open water swimmer. Do you see health benefits from that? And overall, how the benefits focus on wellness and more of a holistic approach to medicine can be helpful to our mental health?
Absolutely, Ethan. I mean, I think when my children were young, I didn't have a chance to look after my mental health. And I think a lot of mothers from my generation, they were expected not to be mothers. They were expected to be professionals 10 hours a day. My job was a 10-hour a day job. And whether or not you had children made absolutely no difference. You had to perform the same as a man or you weren't as good as a man. So I think we're in a much more aware world now. We're aware that we're multifaceted and we have bodies and our brains are part of our bodies and our bodies are part of our brains. And we have to look after both. So, you know, we can talk in a holistic way about everything, but we also have to be disciplined. I found myself that, yes, you can think it out and you can talk about holistic approaches to things. But, you know, you have to put that holistic approach into practice as well. In the very cold weather, I was swimming in water today that was 6.5 degrees centigrade. It's very cold, very, very cold. And I didn't want to get in. And everybody on the pier, nobody wanted to get in. So we all just looked at each other and we do that every morning. And then you just get in. You know, maybe you don't want to go on a run, but you go on the run. And your reward, you have to have your eye on the reward. The reward is how you will feel afterwards. And sometimes I don't know whether my virtuous feeling comes from having plunged into cold water, got my heart rate up, waited and swam until the water no longer feels cold and I feel really reinvigorated. Or it just comes from my self-satisfaction of having succeeded in doing it. So it's physical and it's mental. So I would say two things. Yes, try and have a holistic approach, but you've got to marry it with discipline. That's my wisdom.
I always think you rarely regret that piece of exercise you've done, even if it is hard to get out of bed to do it. You rarely feel worse after it. So I think that that's the important part. And beginning of this answer, you spoke a little bit about the next topic I want to talk to you about, which is about representation, particularly of women within medicine and also as patients, because we spoke about your focus on perinatal medicine and postpartum depression. And we've spoken to other guests on this podcast around women's health and how it gets less attention at times. Women get treatment later than men for some conditions. What are your thoughts on that, having risen through the ranks of medicine, both on the representation of women in medicine as practitioners and as patients on the other side? Are they getting the attention they deserve?
Well, of course not. Is the answer. I mean, why would medicine be any different to any other aspect of life? The way women were treated in gynecology and obstetrics was beyond disgraceful. It was absolutely horrific to witness it as a medical student. I was actually doing my obs and gyne training in 1983, and that was during an abortion referendum in Ireland, where abortion was banned from being enacted in our legislation. In other words, people in Ireland voted to put a constitutional ban on ever having abortion services in Ireland. And one of the best days of my life was when that ban was overturned in May 2018. And some women in Ireland had worked for 40 years to get that ban lifted. And now we have abortion services for women. It has been a very long, hard struggle, both for women trying to get abortion services and for women within medicine, I would say. And I also have to say that a lot of women weren't very supportive of women. It may not be a popular thing to say, but I think we can see it in more public areas, like in the acting area, where I just don't think older women supported younger women. I think there was an attitude of, well, this is what you do. You put up with it and then you get top and then you can do what you like. But I never actually, and I'm proud to say this, I never compromised because I was a woman. I would say the only area where it really impacted on me was when I had children. And there were no allowances made. You got 3 months off and that was it. And then you came back to work. If your child was sick, you turned up for your clinic and so on and so forth. So it was very difficult then. But again, that's changing. I mean, fathers are allowed to be parents, which is great for men. So it wasn't just bad for men. It was terrible for men. Men weren't allowed to really effectively parent and to contribute to the emotional nourishment of a child. So, yeah, it was very difficult. I mean, I was often the only woman in the room. And I was very lucky that I never had a problem with self-belief, which I think surprised a lot of people because I didn't get educated in a private school. I didn't come from a particularly privileged background. We had very little money. I went to public schools, but I had loving parents. And they were enlightened parents who knew that education was very important. And I just had self-belief, but I saw women falling right, left and center. And I saw women being decimated by having a lack of self-belief. And I saw men from the sidelines nodding, oh, yeah, typical. You know, there was a terrible attitude towards women. You know, it was systemic. When I went into Trinity College, I can say this 15 years ago, it was a patriarchy. And now we have our first dean of provost in the college, the first in the history of the college, which is over 400 years old. So things have just changed so fantastically, but there's a lot of work to do. And I would say particularly in the area of childbirth and gynecology. I mean, the gynecology situation is absolutely appalling for women. You know, women don't have sexual dysfunction. You know that. Even, of course. Only men have sexual dysfunction. We didn't learn any sexual dysfunction in women. It wasn't on our gynecology course. And there are some fantastic women coming to the fore now and saying, well, actually, there are female sexual disorders. And yeah, it wasn't in the curriculum. I mean, it sounds extraordinary. Pain, dysmenorrhea, pain during periods. There was no research into that. Nothing. Incontinence after childbirth. Nothing. It was just, you know, you bought your pads or whatever you did and you didn't tell anybody about it. So all of these areas, there's some wonderful young women coming in as leaders in these areas and leading the way. And, you know, that's so heartwarming for me to see all these wonderful progresses in areas that were taboo.
And again, it ties to another podcast around femme health, around even some of the innovation in terms of devices. I mean, the fact that women weren't allowed to participate in clinical trials for a long period of time obviously has halted the development of drugs that are suitable for women or the research on women's conditions. So great to hear you're also enthused by the change, the sea change we're seeing in that area. But yeah, well overdue and more work to be done as well, I would think. I just want to return to some personal reflections. We've had a wonderful, rich discussion here. First thing is around, well, it's not really a reflection, but it's an active question. How do you find the time to write and what role does writing play in your life?
Well, writing is the center that has always held my life together. I almost try to do everything else. It's almost like the rest of my life is, it's a process of soothing and sorting to get to my desk. I guess I've always written academic papers, grants. And even when I learn, I learn by writing and taking notes. And so writing has always been very, very central to the way I am in the world. And I have recently retired. So I'm in the fantastic position of being able to physically actually structure my day around my writing. So I'm as happy as I could be at the moment. I'm one of those people who has retired, but is actually doing now what I really wanted to do full time. So I've had a very rich career. I've had my clinical career. I've had my academic career. And now I'm moving into this new phase of full-time writing.
Well, congratulations on that career and on your retirement, which you seem to be very, very filled as well. My last question is around any words of wisdom, creed or motto that you have, maybe that you've gleaned from these various stages of your career, from people who've inspired you, from the poets you read, or just come up with any of your own. Any words that you live by that you can share with us?
What I said earlier, this too will pass. And it's a lot of it has to do with memory. And people often say, you know, you must live in the present. But when you're at your very happiest or your very saddest, you're at extremes of emotion, you're so aware of time and you're so aware of how time passes. And I think an ability to incorporate that into the present rather than just looking at the present is a very finely balanced thing that allows you to glean the best from the moment that you're in, but also to see things in context, to see ourselves as fantastically complex animals who have been born into a period in history where, for most of us, and for the people who are listening to this podcast, I think for most of us in the world that we live in, we're fantastically privileged. We're fantastically privileged to have the awarenesses that have been gifted to us by the evolution in knowledges and the evolution in humanity and in humanism. And I think of myself as just being like a nucleus with all this wonderful world spinning around me in this fantastic balance. And I think just holding the ship steady in a kind of a sense of these multiple awarenesses and how privileged we are to be able to inhabit whatever moment we inhabit as we move through the amazing wonders of the world, of living and of dying and of birth. I think to be aware of the infinite possibilities of life and of the universe and to carry that awareness with you is all I can say, really. For me, that's the ultimate self-realization and self-actualization. That's the point that I'm at in my life, is I just want to absorb that awareness and live all of those various levels of awarenesses with a sense of great privilege. I think we're all moving forward, we're all surviving, and we're kind of like little bees, you know, we're buzzing around, and that awareness of that connection among us all is so vital to each individual. So that sense of being connected and balanced is, I think, what we should strive towards.
Well, Veronica, it's been such a treat to speak with you. You are a sweeping thinker, and I think one of the original systems thinkers, just how you discuss here the integration of everything. I think we're also grateful for the fact that you are a scribe, that you're writing this down, you're distilling it into words that we can all understand, because you truly are someone, I think, who has seen enlightenment at a personal level, not only in the profession that you work. And I think you've given us great hope for the enlightenment that we can all look forward to as we age, to get to that point of mastering abstraction. So thank you so much for this rich conversation and for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you so much, Aoife. It's been a great pleasure.
I'm Aoife Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring people and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.